Okay, so first of all, let's start off. Are there any questions about, again, today's the second homework is due. Any questions about the homework or, you know, or anything we can talk about? So far we've been talking about microarrays, we've been talking about clustering, we've been talking about different algorithmic problems on microarrays. And I would like to sort of conclude that unit and start to move on to something else, okay, today. But first of all, any questions about anything? Okay? So, the first thing I'd like to make sure I remember to announce is that next class, on Thursday, we do not have, I will be traveling. Okay, we will not meet here. Instead, what we will be meeting is that they will be having a class tour, okay, a road trip, a field trip to a genuine biology lab. The place where everybody can go, okay, is into the medical center, okay, the little tower. I'll send out an email about this, but I want to talk about it now. The little tower of the hospital, of the medical center. This is often called the science tower. And it is going to be room 128 on level 6. 124, that's right. 124 on level 6. Okay? So the hospital, I always find to be an impossible place to get around it. Okay, so it's important to understand the basic idea. The basic plan is that there are two parts of the hospital. One is the hospital, there's a big ugly building and a little ugly building. They are connected. You are in a little ugly building. Okay? Now, the tricky part about this is, first of all, that the two buildings, although they're connected, are not connected on every floor, okay? And not every floor on one building stops at the other building and vice versa. So the elevators are complicated, the buildings are complicated. That said, I found this the other day on my first attempt. I went in from here, basically walked to the nearest part of the complex, got into the first elevator that I saw, took that elevator to the level 6, okay? And from level 6, I then, there was a sign that said DNA sequencing facility, okay? And that was room 124, okay? Professor David McKinnon is going to be the one who supposedly will show you around. Because the group is going to be pretty large, you'll be seeing both the DNA sequencing facility and the microarray facility. And they split you in half at each one, so that half goes up to one, half goes up to the other, and hopefully you'll change spots. Show up on time. Again, class starts at 12:15. Make sure that you show up on time and, be polite, okay? So now, first of all, be polite. Second of all, one thing people don't do in labs is when you work with lots of toxic substances, people don't eat and drink in labs, okay? That's considered a bad thing. So don't bring any food, don't bring any drink. Be polite, ask lots of questions. It's okay to ask a question out of the form, how much does something like that cost, if it's an expensive looking piece of equipment. I know I always do, I always find that interesting. Hopefully ask more basic science questions and stuff like that. Any questions about what the lab tour is going to be? Okay. Ying, our PA, is going to be sort of the official responsible party, so don't get her in trouble by doing anything silly. Okay, it'd be bad if that happened. Any questions? Any questions about the lab tour? Okay, hopefully this will be fun. I'm sorry I won't be able to go there, but it seems like better to schedule the tour while I had to be away than miss a lecture. Any questions about that? Okay. Good. Okay, so so far we've been talking about, the last couple of classes we've been talking about microarrays, and pretty much tired of talking about microarrays for now. Okay, you'll get a better idea, hopefully, about you should right now have a basic idea of the basic problems with microarrays. The, you know, the idea that you know what they do, what kind of data that they give you, you know, what kind of things you might want to do with that data. And hopefully it'll seem even more concrete when you talk to when you go and see the facilities in action. I have a couple extra slides on microarray stuff that I think it's on the web, and unless I run out of slides today, I won't go into that now. But what I'd like to do is to start shifting to sort of the next topic that we're going to look at in biology. Namely, start to look at a little unit on sort of molecules and somehow the shapes and structures of molecules. Okay? So far as, again, you know, we've been living, for the most part, in a sequence-based world. And I'm very happy about that. I'm a computer scientist. I like to work with strings. Strings are linear sequences of bases. Okay? So I usually like to work in sequence world. And it is, you know, there's a lot of things you can do in biology just thinking about sequences. Because all the major sort of players, the major molecules, you know, DNA molecules, RNA molecules, and proteins, are all in one sense linear molecules. Okay? We've talked about how every one of them is synthesized. Okay? And it's clear that somehow there is a linear structure of them because they're basically built one base at a time. Okay? And so this linear structure exists and it's important. Okay? I mean, proteins, we saw that proteins are built sort of one base at a time. We have this idea that RNAs are copies of regions of DNA that are sort of copied at one base at a time. You've all seen pictures of the double helix in these individual strands. That's sort of a nice long, that the replication happens basically one base at a time. So they're linear molecules. However, in reality, their function is, when they function, they're not usually behaving as linear molecules, okay? That the function of molecules tends to depend upon how they interact with other molecules, okay? And in the environment that the biological model, in the cell, environment of interest, these molecules tend to have other shapes than linear. Okay, they tend to fold up in, you know, these linear chains of residues tend to fold up into more complicated shapes. And it's these complicated shapes that govern the interactions between different molecules. You know, it's common to think about molecules as sort of being, again, how you think about them, you know, varies probably according to your training. I'll think of these molecules typically as being some geometric shape. Okay? And, you know, you can think of them as parts, and sometimes parts lock with each other. That tends to be an interesting thing, that sort of things bind to each other, they lock to each other. And these bindings and these interactions are largely a function of shape. Okay, so once we have determined, let's say, the linear structure of the molecule, what is the sequence of bases that it contains? The next question that gets asked typically, and a very important question, is what is the three-dimensional, what is the higher level structure of these molecules? Okay? Any questions? It should be clear that that's a reasonable thing to be talking about. Okay? Because these are molecules, they are in three dimensions, and they do things that way. Any questions? So, one of the most important classes of, let's say, computational problems related to biology are so-called folding problems. Basically, given as input a DNA sequence or an RNA sequence or a protein sequence, try to predict what the three-dimensional structure of that molecule is. Okay? And these are very, very important problems, some of which are very, very hard. Okay? And they're also somewhat messy problems. Okay? The three-dimensional structure of a molecule tends to depend on lots of different things. Okay? What I think of it as depending, again, remember, I'm a computer scientist, so you should take this with a certain grain of salt. But when I think of the three-dimensional molecule structure as depending, it depends upon what intermolecular bonds get formed. Okay, that quite often you've got a
smaller, the three-dimensional structure is grossly formed by certain parts of the molecule interacting with itself,
okay,
and forming arms within itself,
okay,
and that's one of the important components of the three-dimensional structure.
Another important component is sort of these electrostatic forces. Okay, I know that they're positively charged particles and negatively charged particles, and they attract each other, and negatively charged particles repel each other. Okay, so
you can sort of imagine that this part of the molecule was positively charged, and this part of the molecule was negatively charged, and this part of the molecule was flexible and could bend. Okay, it very well might be that these electrostatic forces will pull these two pieces together, okay, as much as that bending part will allow it. So what parts are positively charged and negatively charged makes a difference in structure.
Okay, that should really be important. The size and shape of the individual molecular units is important. I mean, exactly how you think of one of these linear molecules.
I tend to think of it as being a chain of letters, a sequence of letters, because it's a string. But if you think about a protein, each one of these letters stands for a nucleotide, for a amino acid, right? That's a small piece of molecule. You know, so they're sort of these small three-dimensional molecules that are bonded together in some way. Okay? And there's no reason why. I mean, we assign these different letters. We write these letters in the same spot. They look the same size. But they're not necessarily the same size. And these are different molecules. And so they have different properties. Some might be larger than others. Some might be smaller than others. Some may be, mostly different shapes. And if you think about it, the shape of these subunits is really going to affect the shape of any chain of these subunits. Okay, so there's some constraints as to how things fold depending upon the individual pieces. Okay? Any questions? That should be kind of obvious. Again, you know, the level of abstraction of which you think about one of these molecules varies depending upon what you're doing with it. As for pattern mapping, we just thought of them as sequences of bases. For certain other molecules, you might want to think of them as being a chain of balls, where each nucleotide is modeled by a ball, okay, and maybe certain balls are bigger than others, certain ones are smaller than others, okay? Or you might want to model them by their actual shapes, and they've got, sort of all kinds of, each one of these nucleotides has lots of, just have a lot of different atoms. Okay, they have lots of different particles whizzing around them. So these are complicated shaped things, and depending upon the level at which you're considering it, you get more and more complicated structural issues. Any questions? Guys, so it's clear that the shape of these things, in principle, should take care of that.
Another thing that affects the shape of a molecule is that there is this notion of hydrophobicity, that certain amino acid residues don't like to be near water. Certain amino acid residues like to be near water.
So if you have this flexible chain of molecules, okay, of residues, and a few of them are afraid of water, they will try to crawl into the center of this molecule and be surrounded by the braver, amino acid residues. So the properties of these individual residues also makes a difference as to how the shape folds. Okay? Any questions about that?
And finally, the shape of these things also depends upon environmental conditions. Okay? The shape depends somewhat upon, depends upon the heat. Okay? This should be pretty obvious. If you take an ice cube, it's got a particular shape. You apply heat, it melts and it becomes a different shape. Okay? So heat makes a difference. A lot of the other conditions, okay, the acidity or salinity of the environment, also depends upon what the shape of the molecule actually is. Okay? So actually trying to predict the shape or structure of a molecule in proper detail should take into account all of these things and presumably more. Okay? And that's why on one level, predicting the shapes of molecules, the structure of molecules, should be fairly complicated. Any questions? Yes?
Is this prediction fairly deterministic in the sense that if we have to exactly same sequences under similar conditions, do they always hold the same thing?
Well, the question of, so the question is, if I have a molecule in a particular condition, does it always fold the same way? My general rule is nothing is always true in biology. So the answer should be no, okay, by that principle. The question is why or how often does that happen? Well, one thing we could imagine is that energetically, there might be, there may be a small number of configurations which are, you know, somehow about as good as the current configuration. Okay? So for example, think like about a map, you know, a road map. You know, the nicest folded configuration for a road map. Okay? Somebody who's using the road map and tries to fold it back to this doesn't always get folded back into that nice configuration. Okay? So there's often alternate foldings that are almost as good. Okay? But in general, there's usually a small number of possible states for the molecule to get folded in, as I understand it. And so usually it will stick in one of our other small number of states. Okay? But this is all physics and energies, and it's a complicated business. Any questions? Okay. So
the question of how do you determine structures? Well, there are experimental methods for determining structures.
Okay.
The one that I hear about most, at least, is something called X-ray crystallography. This idea that, let's say you have a protein, you want to figure out the shape of this protein. Well, there's a technique of that you can take these proteins and crystallize them. Okay, and I don't have a clear idea what that means, but I basically think of that as being a stacking the protein, several copies of it up, and aligning them up so that you form the proteins take on some kind of a regular structure to them, and they stack up and form a crystal. And then there are techniques where basically shoot X-rays through this thing, watch the X-rays bounce off parts of the structure, and based on the images you get, you can try to figure out where the molecules what the actual shape of the molecule is from that. These X-ray crystallography techniques are very, very tricky, slow, and complicated. And what's more, in certain cases, could be misleading, because this crystalline structure of the protein may very well not be the structure that it takes in vivo. Okay? So determining the structure, experimentally is very complicated. We would like a program that does as good a job as you can do to make these kind of predictions. Okay, any questions?
Because if you could predict the structure of a molecule in a particular state, this is very, very important for drug discovery, for all kinds of different things. This is a big and important problem. Okay? In fact, when people hear the word computational biology, I don't know, we play this word association game. How many people would use the word protein folding when they heard the word computational biology? Anybody? So if you had to, what comes to mind when you think of computational biology? How many people here, at least at the beginning of the semester, would have said protein folding? Okay, I see a couple of people. Okay, so clearly this is a famous and important problem.
Okay, in the public eye, but we agree it's a messy one. Okay, any questions? Okay. So, one of the both consequences of it being messy and the way the problem being messy and also the problem being hard, okay, that people, when they talk about structure of molecules, usually talk about them on several different levels, okay?
And so one of the first things that I found very confusing when I was talking, learning about, structure of molecules and things like that, people would talk about primary structure, secondary structure, tertiary structure, and occasionally quaternary structure. Okay? And this was very confusing to me, because I was thinking, well, why did they just think about talking about the structure? Okay?
And what it amounts to is these four different terms are sort of define some kind of a hierarchy of how precisely you're specifying the structure of a molecule.
Okay?
When people talk about primary structure of a molecule, what that usually means is just the raw sequence, the linear chain of amino acids,
or the sequence of the linear sequence of nucleotides making up RNA. Primary structure is basically the sequence information,
and not much more than that. Okay? The secondary structure is something that is more interesting than that. Okay, more, you know, let's say, involves more structural information than that. It usually refers to sort of the self-interacting features of the molecule. Okay? So we sort of agree that the primary structure is this linear sequence of bases. It's going to fold up into some structure. As a consequence of folding up,
certain features are going to come in contact with each other. Okay, as we'll see when we talk about RNA folding today. The secondary structure will be pairs of non-adjacent, okay, residues that are going to be binding with each other. Okay, in the case of protein structures, it may be different amino acids that are not next to each other on the chain, but in a three-dimensional structure are close enough to each other that they interact in some way.
So secondary structure is going to be basically the interaction pairs of bases that interact with each other in some sense. Okay? The ternary structure is what I normally think of as the three-dimensional structure. Okay? A geometric description of the molecule. Maybe for every amino acid, you'll describe it by a point in space and say, well, this is where it sits in space. You know, if you rotate the molecule and stick it down. Okay? So this is clearly, if you had the geometric description, if you knew where every amino acid was, you could certainly figure out from that which pairs of amino acids are close to each other. So the secondary structure certainly follows from the ternary structure. Okay? But it's much, much harder, perhaps, to find the ternary structure. Okay? And this is often much more ambiguous. Okay? Maybe the model consists of, again, if you think of the protein as being one of these, a structure built from these sort of balls linked together by a chain of balls, and these are sort of strings. You can sort of imagine that the secondary structure might be certain pairs of balls that got taped together. The structure that you get back there after that might not be completely rigid and might wobble around a lot. Okay? Might be free to wobble around in certain ways. So in this case, the three-dimensional structure wouldn't necessarily have much meaning. Okay? Because, you know, depending upon however you picked up this thing, which can this loosely jointed thing with certain pairs of balls taped together, every time you dropped it on the table, it would take on a slightly different geometric shape. Okay? So the three-dimensional structure is sometimes meaningful, sometimes not. Okay? But when it's meaningful, it's certainly important. Any questions about that? The final thing you sometimes hear people talk about is the quaternary structure, which is interesting knowing in which parts of molecules the structure is interacting with other models. So here you live in a world where you're worried about quaternary structure. You've got as input the three-dimensional structures, the ternary structures of a lot of different molecules. And you want to figure out which ones bind with which other ones and where. Okay? So the important thing to see here is that there are different levels of abstractions. These lower ones are easier to get at experimentally. Okay? And computationally. And depending upon the questions you're answering, may very well have enough meaning for you to solve that. Any questions? Okay? So there's somebody who says, oh, I'm working on secondary structure predictions for RNA. That doesn't mean that they're a wussy and they can't do the three-dimensional prediction. Okay? It's that this is a problem, if you can do this problem accurately, Okay, this will be useful. Okay, and it might very well be that a more accurate way to do this might be more important than a less accurate way to do this, depending upon what you're interested in. Any questions? Okay, good. So let's talk today. What I'd like to talk about is basically DNA and RNA folding. Okay, next class we'll talk about, next class we're going on our field trip, okay, to the, DNA sequencing lab, which is on level 6 of the science tower of the medical center, okay, in room 124. Okay, so that's what we're doing next class. But in the next lecture, I'm going to talk more about protein folding. Today I'd like to limit my attention to sort of structural problems related to DNA folding and RNA folding. Okay? Any questions? Okay, so what do we know about DNA folding? Well, we now know what primary, secondary, and tertiary structure, is. It might be interesting to think about those terms in terms of knowing about DNA molecules, because we've talked a lot about DNA molecules. So what is the primary structure of a DNA molecule? Well, it's basically just a sequence of bases, A, C, T, 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 G, 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 etc. The secondary structure has to do with what bases in the molecule bind with other bases. Okay? And the thing we know about DNA is that it often exists in a double helix. Okay? So what does the double helix mean?
Heard the word double helix before. We agree that that basically is because the DNA in double-stranded form consists of two linear molecules of DNA, each specified by a pair of bases, and each sequence on one, each position on one molecule binds to the complementary A, C, T, G. Binds the complementary base on the other one. So what is the secondary structure of DNA? Well, in double-stranded form, the secondary structure is that the I base in the molecule binds to the N minus I base of the complement. Okay? And so these bonds form the secondary structure. Any questions about that? Now, when you're thinking about DNA as being a double helix, and that means that it forms this sort of spiral, okay? But it is wrong to think of a DNA molecule as being this perfect spiral that forms a stairway to heaven, okay? It's going to have a certain amount of bending to it and structure like that. Okay? And in fact, when you look at how DNA is packed in a cell, remember we said that DNA is formed in the long strands of genomic DNA comprise the chromosomes. Okay? A human consists of 46 chromosomes. Okay, which are arranged in 23 pairs. So your 3 billion base pairs are split across these chromosomes. And that DNA molecule folds into a certain structure in the chromosome. So when you think about it, there's a tremendous amount of DNA in a typical cell. The number I always hear is that if you stretched out the DNA, all the DNA in a single cell, it would be 2 meters long. Cells are tiny. You look at them through microscopes, okay? And 2 meters is long, okay? It's longer than this. It's this plus this, okay? So somehow that long, thin string has to get folded up into the cell somehow, okay? And it's got to get folded in a way that it can open and close and be manipulated and not get all knotted up. I mean, sure, you could imagine you could take a thread 2 meters long, crumple it up in a ball, and, stick it in a tiny packet. But the odds that you're going to be able to get it untangled without having knots is very difficult. So one of the really amazing things that happens in a cell is that somehow that DNA molecule folds consistently into chromosomes.
Okay? That the individual pieces, the chromosomes, fold consistently into objects that are somewhat flexible, but basically have well-defined structures. Okay, like this might be an X chromosome, if you notice. It folded up into these four wings. In fact, this is a linear sequence of something. It had a starting point and an ending point. That when you look at pictures of chromosomes, they fold up into these nice, neat structures. Okay? Here are micrographs of the X chromosome and the Y chromosome, which is one of the sex chromosomes in humans. Okay, now I'm not a biologist, but I think I know which one of these I would call an X. Okay, it's this one. Okay, am I right? Many of our biologists here. Okay, I mean somehow it seems to naturally fold into something that looks sort of like an X. Okay, and the other one folds into this kind of a way. So trying to predict how a whole chromosome would fold, you know, because clearly it folds into a fairly regular structure. It's not a rigid structure. This is flexible and bends and doesn't always look the same in all pictures. Okay? But clearly there is some kind of structure here. Okay? And trying to predict that structure, okay, would be a very, very complicated, you know, problem. Okay? In general, we're not going to really talk about that problem because the act of actually trying to figure out how chromosomes fold is still a very, very challenging. It's probably too new a problem to really be talked about a lot. Just trying to figure out how a string of, you know, several hundred million bases folds would seem, you know, incredibly complicated. But it's clear that there is a problem there to be, you know, to someday be solved. Okay, and it should give us some appreciation of the fact that trying to predict how you somehow went from this, you know, this long DNA sequence of A, C, T, and G to this, okay, is sort of the folding problem, okay, and that's really hard. Any questions? Yeah.
Is this chromosome?
The chromosome, as I understand it, consists only of DNA. Okay, now one thing that it does consist of is, one thing that helps it guide its how it's going to fold and replicate has something to do with these long chains of repeats. Remember we talked about all this junk DNA, these ATs, you know. One thing that does seem to play a role in is it gives it somehow the flexibility to fold in certain ways, okay, or maybe give it some nudges to fold in certain ways. So that may be one of the uses for this sort of, you know, these repeating patterns. Yeah. Okay. Okay, so the claim from a more knowledgeable individual, okay, is that the chromosomes are part DNA and part proteins, okay, and that the effect of these proteins helps to govern the shape of these things. Okay, any questions? Okay, yes. Well, exactly what shape these things will be. So the question of what shape these things will be are somewhat a consequence of their environment. So, I mean, one thing you also hear about these problems, again, we talked about how complicated it is, it depends upon what its environment. One thing that matters also is what other things are in the environment, what other proteins are in the environment. So, for example, one thing you hear about with protein folding is you hear about these shepherd proteins, which help govern how other proteins are going to fold. Okay? So the problem of actually trying to predict what how something is going to fold is not a completely straight, it's an important problem. It is largely a function of just the sequence. Okay? Is it completely a function of just the sequence? Okay? This is maybe, you know, this is less clear. Okay? Probably not true. Okay? Yeah.
That's the time for the same question. We do get electrophoresis for determining the length of the sequence. And now, in that case, how sure can we be about those results correctness if there are other problems?
Okay. So the question here is, how can we use, given the fact that these DNA molecules fold into different things, we've talked earlier about electrophoresis, this idea that there's going to be a way we can measure the lengths of molecules by putting them on a gel, putting a charge on them, and having them walk. And I convinced you somehow that the length, the distance that it walks up the gel is proportional to the length. In fact, what I probably should have done is convinced you that it was more a function of the weight, okay? That somehow that how far you can pull this thing would depend upon how heavy it is, which would be conserved if it was folded up, okay? And basically, you know, to make the mapping then between length and weight would be to assume that all the bases are roughly the same weight, okay? You know, but again, undoubtedly, probably the shape of the molecule does have some impact on how it diffuses through the gel. But that seems to be, at the very least, a second-order term. Okay, I've never heard complaints about that in particular. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So we now have here what should be a somewhat convincing example of molecules that have, where the primary structure, the sequence, is clearly interesting. The secondary structure of this double helix is clearly interesting. This ternary structure of how it is folded up, okay, to form the chromosomes is clearly interesting. The other thing that's also interesting is we talked about how when DNA is in single-stranded mode, the way that transcription happens is that at certain binding sites on the DNA sequence, okay, that other molecules sort of attack itself to start the transcription process. That can convince us that how one molecule and the shape of one molecule interacts with other molecules is also important. So at all these levels, it should be clear you get interesting biological questions. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Good. Okay. So when people talk about folding, again, the computational problems with folding usually start with what we call RNA folding. Okay? That RNA molecules, okay, are like proteins, single-stranded molecules. Okay? So and they tend to fold into sort of predefined structures. Okay? Based on interactions with it. So the computational RNA folding problem would be one where you take as input the sequence of an RNA molecule, ACU, GGG, remember, DNA and RNA are basically equivalent, except the T gets replaced to a, at least on our level that we talk about it, a T gets replaced by a U, okay? And, it sort of folds onto itself. And trying to predict the shape of an RNA molecule is very important in certain applications. One reason why it's important is that we've talked a lot about, we've mentioned transfer RNAs in here. We've mentioned ribosomes in here. There's certain molecules that play an important structural role in biology that are RNAs and not proteins. Most of the things that do things in biology are proteins. But there's certain sometimes the shape of an RNA has a big impact on what it does. Okay, so trying to predict the shape of this is an important problem. Now, protein folding is famous as a hard problem. RNA folding is famous as a relatively easy problem. Okay? And the reason why it's different is that the physics of the two things are quite different. Okay? RNA is a single-stranded molecule, but it sort of bonds within itself analogously to DNA. Okay? And so you get RNA residues want to bind with complementary bases. An A wants to bond with a U. A C wants to bond with a G. Okay, so trying to predict the secondary structure of an RNA is basically talking about the set of pairs that are bonded. Any questions? So here is an example of a picture. Here is a picture that came from a popular RNA folding program. Of the secondary structure of a particular RNA molecule. This is a hemoglobin that comes up in a plant. Okay? So, for whatever it's worth. Okay? But the important thing to see here is, does anybody see where the start and end of the molecule are? Okay? Remember, RNA is a linear molecule. That would mean it should have a start and an end. Can anybody find the start and the end? Okay, well, maybe I can if I can get a little closer here. I believe this is it. Okay, that if you look very carefully, there's no line connecting those two bases. Okay, so here you've got one end of the molecule, there you've got the other end of the molecule, if I'm correct. Okay, and it folds up like this. Each one of these corresponding, the binding pairs are, for the most part, okay, binding complementary bases. Okay, sometimes you have small bulges in the molecule. If you look over here, everything bonded nicely except there was this little bulge here. Sometimes you have big bulges in the molecules. Some places there's going to be what you would call hairpin turns, things at the end of the molecule, where it folds over onto itself and forms a tight bend. Okay? So the secondary structure problem would be given as input the RNA sequence, figure out which pairs want to bind with other pairs. Okay? And in some sense, this drawing is defined. I mean, it's a nice three-dimensional layout. But the actual drawing is not really important. What's important is that the ith pair of this binds with the jth pair of that. Okay? And then there's a question, how do you lay it down so it looks like nothing's crossing? Okay? Any questions? Yeah.
Is it possible to remind them in number of ways?
To what? I'm sorry.
To remind them in number of ways.
Okay. So the question is it possible to align them in different ways? Well, first of all, nature in folding, nature wants to fold. Okay? Maybe like some of the .com companies, they seem to want to fold these days. Okay? And it wants to fold in a way that maximizes the structure. Okay? Or minimizes the energy. People talk about these things in different ways. Okay? So you could imagine that, so in principle, the structure that's going to get formed is going to be the one that has the most energetic bonds, okay, or the most number of, let's say for now, let's say the most number of bonds. Okay? And that might be unique, or as you point out, it might be that this is a way to fold it that gives us 209 bonds. There might be some other folding of this, which would give us 209 bonds. Okay? So it's possible there are a lot of different foldings, different secondary structures that will give us similar energy difference, you know, energy measurements. Okay? But the algorithmic problem that we want is to try to find the one that will have the most bonding things. Okay? How do we deal with the fact that there might be multiple solutions almost as good as with each other? That we'll maybe talk about a little bit later, okay? But it's certainly a problem we have to worry about, okay? Maybe it's the case that although there are lots of different solutions, maybe all of them have this nice structure here where there's this long chain of stacked pairs. And maybe that's the interesting feature in the RNA, okay? So you might hope that even though there might be lots of different solutions, they might have a lot of gross similarities in common. And that might be what is meaningful about the RNA structure. Okay? Any questions? Okay?
Don't
the RNAs interact with each other? Yeah, RNAs interact with each other. So once you have the secondary structure, you may be able to, from here, start to predict something about how it folds in three dimensions. Well, when you say, how do they interact with each other? It may be they interact at the single-stranded pieces. Or it might be that based on this structure, you can sort of predict a little bit how it's going to fold into three dimensions. So I think that finding the secondary structure starts to help you find what it's going to do in three dimensions. And from that, will also help you figure out how these might interact with each other. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. Do these two circles intersect? The answer is no. That is a consequence of the drawing program. Okay? Now, in principle, this can be drawn without actually any intersections. Okay? And that's going to be actually important for our algorithms. But in fact, in nature, it's not necessarily true. Okay? We'll talk about that a little bit soon. Any questions? Okay? So the basic problem that we're going to be interested in, or the basic thing we're going to talk about today, is a approach to RNA folding, which is sometimes called the Zucker-Turner model.
Okay?
And basically what it does is, it says that an RNA molecule is going to fold so as to maximize its structure slash minimize its energy, where its structure is a function of how many pairs bond and where the pairs bond, okay, and which pairs actually bond, okay? So we agree that there are certain substructures that would get formed in such a model. You have these things that at the end, these loops at the end that are called hairpin turns. Okay? You could imagine that, again, if this is a sort of a chain of things, if you want to align and each base represents a link in a chain, you might imagine that at the end of a loop, if you try to squeeze it tight enough, the chain may start to resist as you get a tighter and tighter loop here. So it might be hard to sort of zip this thing up so tight
that everything in the chain, that every base bonds with its complement. Okay? So there is some energy cost associated with having a loop at the end like this, with a certain number of unpaired bases. You get a certain number of points for binding, for linking pairs of bases. You get some point, a certain amount of energy for linking an A with a U, a certain amount for a C and a G. And in fact, because of the chemical nature, for one of those types of bonds is stronger than the other. Okay, you sometimes have different other bonds, okay, that sometimes certain bases will bind to things that are not its complement, so-called wobble bases. So the problem basically is this. We're going to decompose our, we seek to take as inputs, given a certain energy model of knowing how much points you get for binding certain pairs, how much of a penalty you pay for having loops of different types. Try to find the secondary structure that maximizes the amount of structure or minimizes the amount of energy, okay, according to that scoring system. Okay, that's the basic algorithmic problem of the, you know, RNA folding. Okay? Any questions? What? So what I'll claim is that somehow that molecules do not like having big empty loops in them. Okay? That's something that is not a feature of, you know, that there's a, you should get a penalty for having big loops. Okay? It's something that doesn't really exist in real you know, that is not energetically favorable. Okay? You would probably pay a price for having too tight a loop here. Okay? Again, if you think of it as linking chains. So what I claim is that the sort of the general RNA folding model says, look, we're going to try to, we know that RNA molecules have these features. I have gone into the laboratory and measured how much energy it takes to create and break these features. I can assign each one of these structures a score. And my question now is, given the input sequence of a molecule, how do I pair it up so as to maximize my score? Okay? And this should start to smell like a dynamic programming problem to you. Okay? That you somehow want to find things that align with each other. Okay? But it's a little bit different than our regular string problem. Why? Well, first of all, we're binding with ourselves. Okay? And second, once we bind with ourselves, we can't let anybody else bind with us. Okay? So that sort of decomposes somehow. Each binding somehow decomposes the problem into subproblems. Once we decide to bind over here, we are not going to allow ourselves to let one of these bases bind with something outside that structure. Okay? So one consequence of sort of the model here is that we're going to assume that RNA folds in a nicely nested structure. Okay? That once we bind certain pairs together, somehow just the rest of the bind the I pair and the J pair, then the rest of the folding that happens between in the sequence from the I pair to the J pair
interacts only with itself and not with anything outside the molecule. Okay? Any questions? Now, this model, what I basically just said, is that this model of RNA folding ignores something called pseudonyms. Okay? I am explicitly forbidding this base from folding over onto itself and also binding with this. It could be that here I've got an A, here I've got a T. Okay? Because I am insisting that my folding observe this nicely nested structure, I am forbidding you from also, once you've decided to bond this, also bonding this with that. Okay? Now, nature does not forbid that. I forbid it, but nature doesn't. Okay? These kind of self-interactions do exist in real molecules. Okay? But in general, most of the RNA folding programs ignore them for two reasons. One, as we'll see, the algorithmic problem of finding the minimum energy configuration when we ignore these pseudo-knots becomes very tractable and easy, or reasonably tractable and reasonably easy. And second, these pseudo-knots are maybe better off thought of as being part of the ternary structure of the molecule rather than the secondary structure. Okay, so maybe it's better to kick that problem away and worry about it later. But once you know the nicely nested secondary structure, maybe it's easy to then figure out what might bond with what else as a pseudonym. Any question?
Can one particular base form bonds?
Can one base form bonds with more than one? And the answer, as far as I know, is no. Okay? So it's fair to say that when we talk about the secondary structure, each base is bonded to a unique other base. If it's in the secondary structure, each base bonds with at most one other base. However, one of the energetic turns that turns out to be interesting is that it is harder to break a molecule where the bonds occur next to each other than where they're separate. So you might imagine
two possible secondary structures, let's say two different molecules. One of them has this bonded, this not bonded, and this bonded. Okay? Versus having these two bonded, and then a pair not bonded. So you might imagine a situation where here we have two pairs, two bonds, but there's something between them. Here we have two bonds of consecutive sequence bases. This is energetically much stronger than that. You pay a penalty for this, something like an internal loop. Okay? So in fact there is,
There is some energy interaction between neighboring bonds. Okay, although when we talk about secondary structure, every base is going to be bonded to at most one other base. Okay? Any questions? Okay? The thing that's going to be nice about our optimization problem is that there are a lot of these kind of constraints, like that of stacked pairs, that of properly accounting for the cost of these loops, with complicated enough dynamic programming recurrences. You can incorporate all of those sort of energetic observations and cost functions and constraints, okay, to enable you to make reasonably good predictions. Any questions? In general, these folding, RNA folding programs do a reasonably good job. The study that I saw once said that on a typical program by a guy named Zucker, something called M-Fold, which is a very popular RNA folding program, okay, typically gets, when you compare the real secondary structure to what comes out of their program, typically about 73% of the bases get bonded correctly on sufficiently short RNAs. So they do a reasonably good job with this dynamic programming thing, even though they ignore pseudo-knots, even though they ignore other things. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So let's look at the algorithmics. Yes, question. That sounds like, okay, so 70, so let's think what that means. Okay, that's a good question. Is this good or bad? Okay, so is 73% good or bad? That does mean one out of every four bonds is wrong. Okay, that means three out of every four bonds is right. Okay, and is that good or bad? Okay, it would be nice to do better. It is certainly true that as we'll talk about at the end of class, there are other classes of RNA folding algorithms that in special applications will get much more accuracy than this. And so clearly, there is a hunger by certain people for more accuracy. On the other hand, this program gets millions of hits a year. So it's clear that there is a demand for even predictions on this level. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. How accurate is the secondary structure gap to be? Well, what I'd say is probably the case is it's important that you get the important bonds right, and not that you miss and less important it's not so bad if you miss the less important structures. So, for example, here we have our predicted RNA problem. Could I imagine a world where what was really interesting about this molecule, again, I can't really read it, is that there's this long, straight, bonded thing, okay? And that over here, it's sort of, the structure is less well-defined and less important. If you got 90% of these bonds right and 50% of those, that might be, that might capture the important structure. It is probably the case that the most important bonds probably occur in longer structures and, are reinforced and, the other molecule where it's important, it's probably, you would expect that it's probably easier for the program to find it. So I could easily believe that it will find the important parts of the structure more readily than the less important. Any questions? But whenever you make a prediction, you can be wrong. Okay? We have an election tonight. Okay? They make predictions, maybe they'll be wrong. Okay? Any questions? Okay, good. So how do we fold these things? Okay, let's look at an algorithm for, a simple algorithm for folding RNA. And the simplest algorithm would be the following. Okay, that let's say we are going to ignore the fact, for the most part, let's say we're going to ignore the fact that different pairs of bases, A's and C's, bond differently. I mean, A's and C's bond with different energy than C's and T's, G's and T's. We'll ignore the fact that we pay different penalties for different kinds of loops, okay, whether it's a hairpin of a particular length, or we don't care about whether or not we ignore the fact that we get energetic benefits by having long runs of stacking pairs rather than having gaps between them. Let's say that the simplest problem is given as input an RNA sequence, knowing that each base can bind only to its complement. How do we find a way to fold it so that it has the nice nesting property and we maximize the number of bonds? Okay? I claim the following kind of a recurrence is all that you really need. We're going to let EIJ be the maximum number of properly nested bonds we can get by folding the I through J bases in a sequence S. Okay? So what is E sub II going to be? Let's think about the limiting case here. What if the string was of length 1? What's the maximum number of bases you can get? Okay, it should be 0. Okay, so we know the limiting condition pretty well. Okay? I'm going to claim that for any given pair, either they bond, okay, or they don't bond. Okay, there's no real other choice here in our simplified model. So what is the maximum number of bonds from I to J? Well, if they bond, okay, then how many bonds can we get? Well, If we decide to bond them, we get credit for a bond if they bind properly. So AIJ is going to be the score we get for matching the ith character here with the jth character here. In our simplified model, we would get 1 if these two were of different, you know, if one was, you know, one was an A and one, if one was an A and one was a U, we would get 1. If one was a C and one was a G, we would get 1. Otherwise, we would get 0 for this. Okay? Basically, if we decide to bind those two together, then the price we get is 1 for that, plus the cost of the optimal way of folding the intervening part of the sequence. Okay? Namely, in one character from the left and in one character from the right. Okay? Any questions? Yeah? Yes, you're right. Okay, so the answer is, should these be maxes? The answer is probably right. Okay, and one reason why did I make this mistake? Well, one reason is because people, I find this area very confusing, is people talk about minimizing energy or maximizing structure. Okay, so you have to be a little bit careful here. I goofed. Okay, but we agree, we want to maximize these things. If we're talking about bonds, we want to talk about maximizing the number of bonds as opposed to minimizing the energy somehow. Okay, you're right, these should be maxes. Okay, so what do we get here? We then get that, again, we can maximize, what are our choices? Well, we could decide to try to bind that. Or if not, if the I space is not going to bind with the J space, it may very well be that, let's say, the I space is going to bind with something further in. Okay? We could imagine a situation where our molecule is going to look something like this. Here is the I space, here is the J space. Okay? It might be that I have decided to bind with some character at some position K, where K lies between I and J. Okay? Or it might be that J has decided to bind with somebody within some K between I and J. Or it might be that either of them really bind. These are completely at the same base as that. And everything bonds and zips up tight between them. So I claim that we've got to consider all possible choices of how somehow the problem is going to get decomposed into nested regions. Let's find out which one I gets nested with. Okay? So we're going to try all possible positions K between I and J. And then decompose the sequence into the chain form from I to K and K to J. Okay? And the total number of bonds we get, we want these should both be, that should be a max, that should be a max. Okay? We either will bind I and J together explicitly and get credit for that, or if they don't bind, okay, we're going to have to somehow decompose this string into two pieces. Okay, and the score that we get is the sum of the two nesting pieces. The scores we get on the two nesting pieces. Any questions? Okay. Is that clear or any questions? Okay. So what is the algorithmic cost of this dynamic program? Okay. First of all, what is the actual value we're ultimately interested in at the end? What are the values of I and J for a string of length n? Okay. We want to know what is the maximum number of bonds I can get folding the sequence starting from I from one to n. So I would be 1 and J would be n. Okay. And so we really have n squared cells, because there's an I, you know, every possible start position and stop position, there's n choose 2 of those. The algorithmic cost of evaluating this, we're trying every intermediate point here. Okay? I claim that will take order n time. This gives us an n cubed time algorithm to find the maximum number of binding pairs.
Assuming we respect
the nesting condition. Okay? Any questions? Yeah. This? Okay, this says that if we decided to bind these two,
suppose, let's say, I'm trying to figure out, gee, how do I fold my RNA? And someone whispers in my ear, says, hey, the I pair and the J pair are going to bind. So, okay, I'll take their word for it. I'm going to get one credit for that bond. And now I finish the job. I've got to fold the sequence that goes. Remember, there's two ends of the sequence. Between I and J, there is a continuous piece of sequence, right? So we now need, once we've decided to bond this, the recursive part of our problem is that now we have to bind from I plus 1 to J minus 1. Namely, that subpiece that will get cut off if we cut at I and J.
Okay? Any questions? Okay? So this should convince us that we could maximize binding pairs in n cubed time. Okay? Any questions? Okay? In fact, you need a fairly complicated, more general set of recurrences, okay,
to take into account these loops and properly account for loops and stacking energies. And
the recurrences are a little bit complicated looking, but the basic idea should be pretty clear once we understand what we did before, okay? That we're going to have an energy function that is going to be telling us basically what is the optimal way of folding up the subsequence from the ith character to the jth character. How much energy does it give us? Okay? I'm going to now have a nested sequence of recurrences that are going to properly reward us or make us pay penalties for the reward us for long runs of stacked pairs. Okay, it will punish us for having loops. Okay, and we can have, so the basic principle is going to be that we can build more complicated recurrences along the lines of what we saw to capture these other constraints. Okay? And the odds that I type these things in properly is vanishingly small. Okay, so, but let's just try to go through them to get a flavor of these recurrences. Okay? So we're going to let Vij denote the minimum energy of the structure enclosed by the ith character of the sequence and the jth character of the sequence. Okay? Again, we're going to get a bonus, okay, if we if we have a run of a pair of characters, I and I plus 1, that bind to J and J minus 1. That would mean that we have,
again, these are consecutive bases on the sequence. If we get two that bind next to each other, we get some extra points for that. So how might we, in principle, store that in our dynamic programming state? We could have the state of our recurrence encode whether or not the previous value ended with a stacking pair or not. If it ended with a pair that bound, and now we decide to bind this. We knew the cost of what it took to end up at I plus one, J minus one, ending on a stacking pair. We can appropriately give us the extra points for having two in a row, okay, by using the appropriate subvalue of that recurrence.
Okay? So, what we're basically going to give us is the energy of the structure enclosed by a stacking pair here, okay, is going to be the energy we get for binding these two, okay, meaning does this base bind with itself? How much of an energy do we get for connecting that base to itself? And adding to it the value of the appropriate sub-expression further up, Okay? So we get capture that kind of a notion. We get penalties ascribed for having turns. We could imagine an energy bundle penalty like this, because the energy of a hairpin.
Meaning that the thing closes, that we have at the end a bubble, and then we start binding these two together.
The energy of such a thing is going to be the points we get for binding the I character and the J character to create the hairpin, plus the penalty that's a function of the size of the loop that gets created here.
So if we decide to start our hairpin here, we get some points for binding these and lose some points for as a function of the length of the loop. Okay?
And that's going to be the term that ends in a hairpin. Or we might have a structure that ends, that IJ might be a binding pair that joins encloses a loop, an internal loop.
So remember a structure like this. Suppose that we decide that really the optimal solution was that this got bounded here. There was a bow of a certain number of bases on this side, a certain number of bases on the other side. How much do we pay for this? Well, if we decide that there's going to be a K1 bases on the left and K2 bases on the right of this loop, what should the score that we pay be? Well, we get credit for whatever it took to match above this. We get credit for this particular stacking pair. We lose points for having an internal loop of like K1 plus K2. Okay? And so you get a recurrence term that looks something like this,
where the optimal way of ending I and J on an internal loop is we find a pair K and L such that we get the credit for binding I and J. We get credit for the substructure nested from K to L. And we pay a penalty proportional to the sum of the lengths, the distance from I to K and L to J. That's the number of unbound things in our loop.
Any questions? I will sort of see where this recurrence is coming from. People don't see it and want to see it. Some people don't see it at all, don't want to see it. Okay, no one will admit to it.
But what's interesting about this? What is the cost, though, of potentially updating this cell? Okay? Let's look at this recurrence, though. Suppose we have one cell here. Let's say the cell where I is 1 and J is N. What is the cost of doing this computation here, at least as this recurrence is written? The cost of how much time will it take to optimize this, do this min? N squared. Why is that? Because there's two free variables here. Okay? And you've got to pick, so potentially you have to pick one from N, one from N. N squared possible choices here to optimize it. Given that there are N squared possible choices here, this kind of a constraint potentially blows up the cost of our evaluation to N to the fourth. Does everybody sort of see that? Okay. Now, one way we can avoid this is to say, well, internal loops aren't that big. We say that the internal loops are never more than 30 bases long. Okay. Then we can insist that our K be within 30 of I and J within 30 of L be 30 of J. And then it would be only constant time to set this thing. Okay? So these real programs tend to make constraints like that. Okay? Decreasing the running time, but potentially increasing the optimal cost. Okay? Because it could be that again, although it's very rare in nature for there to be loops larger than 30. Okay? It may very well be that that's the energetically favorable thing for certain molecules. Any questions? Okay, but paying an extra factor of n would be an expensive hit on a long molecule. Any questions? Okay. Then finally, there's the most complicated structure here. The multi-loops. What was a multi-loop? An internal loop, which was the case that I just handled here, had one stack going through a hairpin and one stack representing our business end. But look over here. Here we have a loop that is closed by one, two, three different branches.
Okay.
In principle, we might have a loop that is closed by an arbitrary number of sub-branches.
Okay. Does everybody see where this potentially causes us trouble in a recurrence? Why? Suppose we don't know how many pairs there are of these sort of structural, these sub-branches that get formed. One way we could optimize it is by picking all subsets of possible branches. But that starts to get to have an exponential kind of thing, right? If we don't know, if all we know that there is going to be a branch, let's say there's going to be 10 branches. One way to try to optimize it, a 10-branch loop ending here, would be to pick the 20 pairs of bases, each of which is going to get define that sub-branch, and optimize over all possible choices of those 20 bases. But that's sort of an expensive thing. Does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay? Instead, the way that these recurrences work is that they have two terms. Okay? WIM is going to be the contribution of the subsequence from I to J to a multi-loop which contains I and J. V sub I and J is going to be the contribution of the energy to a multi-loop that is closed by this bond. Okay? So we're going to maintain two possible states, the cost of an open loop and the cost of a closed loop. Okay? So our multi-loop is going to be the following. If we've decided to close it, okay, at their IK, J, if we've decided we're finally going to close up our multi-loop, which happens over here in this particular sequence, then what is the way to do it? Well, we are going to pay the cost. We pay the cost of that bond. Okay. Plus, we now know that there is going to be a last other open multi-loop branch. In this case, this. So we're going to want to know what was the cost, the energy that we get from the cheapest open multi-loop ending in here, okay, plus the cost of closing it from there to there. So here we pay the cost of the multi-loop that ended at the next to last place, that went up until the last multi-loop, and here we go from the multi-loop, last branch to the boundary. And my claim is that if you properly massage these recurrences, you can avoid having to actually explicitly pick all possibilities. This is only where you're charging a penalty for, you get a certain points for ending the multi-loop, okay, and, you know, a certain point for each term within it. Any questions? Okay? As long as we can get the details of that, okay? But the basic principle is the optimal energy ending from I to J is I could either end on a stack, I could end on a hairpin, I could end on a multi-loop, or I could end on a closed multi-loop. Okay? And so here I've got n squared cells. We saw that the dominant cost of updating a cell could be n squared. The cost of the total optimization might be n to the fourth. Okay? But again, by playing various games with what the shape of my penalty function is, or not evaluating all cells, I can come up with a faster prediction
it is almost as good. Any questions?
Good.
Finally, let me just mention the one other class of RNA structure prediction program. Yes, question. So what you are saying is somehow I picture some, I don't know if it's a holistic approach, but God knows,
in the start at the beginning you have a loop here. And what you want to find is saying, oh, maybe this is going to start to close here. And this is going to start to close here. Well, that is in principle what the dynamic program is doing. It is trying all possible starting and ending points, all possible closure points, and figuring out how much of a point you get for squeezing it over in that place. Maybe you want to think of some kind of a, instead of optimizing all possibilities, maybe you re-squeezing program. You find out which pair squeezes off the largest amount, and then which other pair squeezes off the next largest amount. You won't necessarily get a global optimum by sort of just making those decisions locally. What's nice about the dynamic program is it makes the decisions over a global optimum. Any questions?
Finally, just to sort of mention for completeness, is that these, again, these de novo RNA prediction programs based on dynamic program, they're reasonably good, they're popular, but they're not always perfect. One problem is that in general they only return one solution. And as we've seen, that it may very well be the case there's lots of solutions with the same score. Or, again, you have a homework problem to that effect. When you dynamic programming, you might have had a lot of, what about the string alignment? You might possibly get lots of alignments that give the same score. The same problem you have here, you might get lots of structures with the same score. Okay, and this doesn't really help you with determining the variation or what's conserved. So one approach to doing RNA structure prediction that is more accurate for functional RNAs is to notice that if you have a very important RNA, like a transfer RNA for a particular codon, this exists in humans, it exists in mice, it exists in yeast, there's going to be these RNA genes that take these RNAs.
And because of evolution, there's going to be differences between the transfer RNA for a particular codon in yeast than in humans. But the parts of it that are most important for the shape are probably going to be conserved. If let's say the secondary structure of this RNA was very important, what really made the RNA work was that it was this noose. Okay? And that these bonds are what is important for the thing to happen. You might imagine as this loop to be free to wander and wasn't that important. You can imagine there might have been a lot of mutations over the years to change the contents of the loop, but there had better never have been anything to break these bonds. So I might come up with the problem, what if I align the RNAs of yeast and human or something like that, or yeast and different bacteria and things like this? If there's a conserved pair, okay, a strongly conserved pair across species that has always maintained the opposite polarity, a good reason for that is probably that this has some important part of the structure. And while there may have been mutations that caused both of them to change, it's unlikely that one change and one thing that would break the structure. So by aligning these sequences, seeing where they're in the lot of conserved sequence, you can start to get a sense as to what the real secondary structure might be.
Okay? And this is important for functional RNAs where you really want to determine the structure. Any questions? Okay, so turn in your homework and
remember that on Thursday, you're going to the Medical Center, Science Tower, 6th floor, level 6, room 124, DNA sequencing facility.
Thank you.